can, I said. Can you live with that? His lips tightened as he thought. He wasn't a man for facile answers. If he couldn't live with it, he'd tell me.
Is it a matter that I might need to make preparation for? He asked seriously. If it might cause a fight of some kind, I mean, I should need to be ready.
Oh. I let out the breath I'd been holding, somewhat relieved. No. No, it isn't anything like that. More of a moral question kind of thing. I could see that he wasn't happy about that. His eyes searched my face, and I saw the troubled look in them. But at last he nodded slowly.
I'll live with it, Anian, he said softly, and kissed my forehead. For now.
Chapter 143. Interruptus. The other major things requiring a healer's attention in summer were pregnancy and birth. I prayed every day that Masali had safely delivered her child. Even though it was already June the 1st, it would likely be months before we had any news. But I had examined her before we parted company, with tears, in Charleston, and all seemed normal.
Do you think this one might be like Henri Christian?
She spoke the name with difficulty and pressed a hand to her swelling belly. Probably not, I said, and saw the emotions ripple across her face like wind passing over water. Fear, regret, relief. I crossed myself with another quick prayer and walked up the path to the MacDonald cottage, where Rachel and Ian were staying until Ian could build them a place of their own. Rachel was sitting on the bench out front, shelling peas into a basin, the basin sitting comfortably atop her stomach.
"Metting va?" she said, smiling in delight when she saw me. "Is thee not impressed with my linguistic facility, Claire? I can say good morning, good night, how are you, and bugger off to St. Kilda now."
"Congratulations," I said, sitting down next to her. How does that last one go?
I gather St. Kilda is actually a figure of speech indicating some extremely remote location, rather than being specified as the actual destination.
I wouldn't be at all surprised.
Do you try to impose the principles of plain speech on Gaelic?
Or is that even possible?
I have no idea, she said frankly. Mother Jenny proposes to teach me the Lord's Prayer in Gaelic. Perhaps I can tell from that, as presumably one addresses the Creator in the same sort of voice that one uses for plain speech.
Oh.
I haven't thought about that, but it was sensible.
So you call God thee when speaking to him?
Of course. Who should be a closer friend?
It hadn't occurred to me, but presumably that was why one used thou, thy, etc. in prayer. That was originally the familiar form of the singular pronoun you, even though common English speech had now moved on and lost the distinction, save for the friend's plain speech.
How interesting, I said.
And how is Oggy today?
Restless, she said, catching the edge of the basin as a vigorous kick made it bounce, scattering peas.
So am I, she added,
as I brushed the spilled peas off her petticoat and poured them back into the pan.
I don't doubt it, I said, smiling.
Pregnancy actually does last forever, until suddenly you go into labour.
I can't wait, she said fervently. Neither can Ian.
Any particular reason?
A slow, glorious blush rose up from the neck of her shift and suffused her to the hairline.
I wake him 6 times a night rising to piss, she said, avoiding my eye. And Oggy kicks him nearly as much as he does me.
And? I said invitingly.
The blush deepened slightly.
He says he can't wait to, suckle me, she said diffidently.
She coughed, and then looked up, the blush fading a little.
Really? She said, now serious. He's anxious for the child. Thee knows about his children by the Mohawk woman. He said he told thee. making up his mind if it was right for him to marry again.
Ah. Yes, he would be.
I laid a hand on her belly, feeling the reassuring pressure of a thrusting foot and the long curve of a tiny back. The baby hadn't dropped, but Oggie was at least head down. That was a great relief. It will be all right, I said, and squeezed her hand. I'm sure of it.
I'm not afraid for myself at all, she said, smiling, and squeezing back.
The smile faded a little as she put her hand on her stomach.
But very much afraid for them.
The weather being fine, and the smallest Higgins teething, we took a pair of quilts and walked up to the house site after supper to enjoy the long twilight and a little privacy.
You don't think we're likely to be interrupted by a bear or some other form of wildlife, do you? I asked, shimmying out of the rough gown I wore for foraging.
No. I spoke with Joe Beardsley yesterday. He told me the nearest bear is a good league that way.
He nodded toward the far side of the cove.
And they dinna travel far in the summer, while the eating's good where they are, and painters wouldna trouble wee people, while there are easier things to kill. I'll make a wee bitty fire, though, just on principle.
How's Lizzie? I asked, unfolding the quilts as I watched him assemble a small fire with deft efficiency.
Did Joe say?
Jamie smiled, eyes on what he was doing.
He did, at some length. The meat of it being that she's well enough, but somewhat inclined to bite pieces out of him and Kezie to distract her mind. That's why Joe was out hunting. Kezie stays in when she's fratchety, because he canna hear her so well.
The Beardsley twins were identical, and so alike that the only sure way to tell which you were talking to was that Keziah was hard of hearing as the result of a childhood infection.
That's good. No malaria, I mean.
I'd visited Lizzie soon after our arrival and found her and the brood thriving, but she'd told me that she'd had a few spells of fever during the last year, doubtless owing to lack of the Jesuit bark. I'd left her with most of what I brought from Savannah. I should have thought to ask if they had any at the trading post, I thought, and pushed away the heavy sense of uneasiness that came with the thought of that place, thinking firmly, I forgive you. The fire built, we sat feeding its sticks and watching the last of the sunset go down in flaming banners of golden cloud behind the black pickets of the farthest ridge. And with the light of the fire dancing on the stacked timbers and the piles of foundation stones, we enjoyed the privacy of our home, rudimentary as said home might be at the moment. We lay peacefully afterward between our quilts. It wasn't cold, but so high up, the heat of the day vanished swiftly from the air, and watched the flickering lights of chimney sparks and lighted windows in the few houses visible among the trees of the cove. Before the lights were extinguished for the night, we were asleep. I woke some time later from an erotic dream, squirming slowly on the lumpy quilt, limbs heavy with desire. This seemed to happen more frequently as I grew older, as though making love with Jamie ignited a fire that didn't quite die, but continued to smoulder through the night. If I didn't wake enough to do something about it, I'd wake in the morning, stupid and foggy with unslaked dreams and unquiet sleep. Fortunately, I was awake, and while still very pleasantly drowsy, quite capable of doing something about it. The process made much easier by the presence of the large, warm, pungent-smelling male beside me. He shifted a little as I edged onto my back, making a little space between us, but resumed his regular heavy breathing at once, and I edged my hand downward, encountering tumid warmth. It wouldn't take long. A few minutes later, Jamie shifted again, and my hand stilled between my thighs. Then his hand slid swiftly under the quilt and touched me in the same place, nearly stopping my heart.
I didn't mean to interrupt you, Sassenach, he whispered in my ear. But would you like a bit of help with that?
I said rather faintly.
What did you have in mind?
In answer, the tip of his tongue darted into my ear, and I let out a small shriek. He snorted with amusement and cupped his hand between my legs, dislodging my own fingers, which had gone rather limp. One large finger stroked me delicately, and I arched my back.
"Oh, you're well started, then," he murmured. "You're slick and briny as an oyster, Sassenach." "You hadn't finished yet, though."
"No, I..." "How long were you listening?"
"Oh, long enough," he assured me,
and, ceasing operations for a moment, took hold of my disengaged hand and folded it firmly round a very enthusiastic bit of his own anatomy.
"Hmm?"
"Oh," I said.
"Well?"
My legs had taken stock of the situation much more quickly than my mind had, and so had he. He lowered his head and kissed me in the dark with a soft, eager thoroughness, then pulled his mouth away long enough to ask,
"How do elephants make love?"
Fortunately, he didn't wait for an answer, as I hadn't got one. He rolled over me and slid home in the same movement, and the universe shrank suddenly to a single vivid point. A few minutes later, we lay under the blazing stars, quilt thrown off, and hearts thumping slowly back to normal.
"Did you know," I said, "that your heart actually does stop for a moment at the point of climax? That's why your heartbeat is slow for a minute or two after. The sympathetic nervous system has fired all its synapses, leaving the parasympathetic to run your heart, and the parasympathetic decreases heart rate."
"I noticed it stopped," he assured me. "Didn't I really care why, as long as it started again."
He put his arms over his head and stretched luxuriously, enjoying the cool air on his skin.
"Actually, I never cared whether it started again either."
"There's a man for you," I remarked tolerantly. "No forethought."
"You didn't need forethought for that, Sassenach.
What were you doing when I interrupted you, I mean?
Admit, if there's a woman involved, you have to think of all sorts of things, but no for that."
He paused for a moment.
Did I not serve you well enough earlier, Sassenach?"
he asked, a little shyly.
"I would have taken more time, but I couldn't wait, and..."
"No, no," I assured him. "It wasn't that. I mean, I just enjoyed it so much, I woke up wanting more."
"Oh. Good."
He relaxed with a deep, contented sigh, closing his eyes. There was a waxing moon, and I could see him clearly, though the moonlight washed all colour from the scene, leaving him a sculpture in black and white. I ran a hand down his chest and lightly over his still flat belly. Hard physical labour had its price, but also its benefits, and cupped his genitals, warm and damp, in my hand.
"There is a lucky limb stretched against you," he said,
putting a big hand over mine.
"A what?"
I said. "A lucky leg?"
"Well, limb, really. Leg would be overstating it by a good deal. There is a lucky limb stretched against you. It's the first line of a poem by Alistair MacWhistler. Alistair, to an excellent penis, it's called."
"Thought highly of himself, did Alistair?"
"Well, he doesn't he say it is, though I admit that's the implication."
He squinted a little, eyes still closed, and declaimed,
"There is a lucky limb stretched against you that has made 1,000 conquests, an excellent penis that is leathery, well-equipped, sharp-pointed, piercing, firm, lubricated, sinewy, chanter-like, strong, durable, long-enduring, vigorous, powerful, joyous, that would not jilt either soft or hard body."
"I've missed a few of the finer points. He can't really have compared his penis to a bagpipe's chanter, can he?"
"Oh, aye, he did,"
Jamie confirmed. "Leathery, is it?" I said, giggling. "I don't wonder after 1,000 conquests. What does he mean, well-equipped, though?"
"I wouldn't ken. I suppose I must have seen it once or twice.
having a piss by the side of the road, I mean. But if so, I wasn't greatly struck by its virtues.
You knew this, Alistair. I rolled over and propped my head on my arm.
Oh, aye, so did you. Though you maybe didn't ken he wrote poetry, you not having much Gaelic in those days.
I still didn't have a great deal, though now we were among Gaelic-speaking people again, it was coming back. Where did we know him? In the Rising? He was Prince Charlie's Gaelic tutor.
Aye. He wrote a great many poems and songs about the Stuart cause.
And now that he reminded me, I thought I did perhaps recall him. A middle-aged man singing in the firelight, long-haired and clean-shaven, with a deep cleft in his chin. I'd always wondered how he managed to shave so neatly with a cut-throat razor. Hmm. I had distinctly mixed feelings about people like Alistair. On the one hand, without them stirring the pot and exciting irrational romanticism, the cause might easily have withered and died long before Culloden. On the other, because of them, the battlefields and those who had fallen there were remembered. Before I could think too deeply on that subject, though, Jamie interrupted my thoughts by idly brushing his penis to one side.
"The schoolmaster made me learn to write with my right hand," he remarked, "but luckily it didn't occur to anyone to force me to abuse myself that way, too."
"Why call it that?" I asked, laughing.
"Abusing yourself, I mean." "Well, masturbate sounds a great deal more wicked, aye? And if you're abusing yourself, it sounds less like you're having a good time."
"Strong, durable, long-enduring," I quoted, stroking the object in question lightly. Perhaps Alistair meant something like glove leather.
"Vigorous and powerful it may be, Sassenach, and certainly joyous. But I tell you, it's no going to rise to the occasion 3 times in one night. Not at my age."
Detaching my hand, he rolled over, scooping me into a spoon shape before him, and in less than a minute was sound asleep. When I woke in the morning, he was gone. Chapter 144. Visit to a Haunted Garden. I bloody knew. From the moment I woke to birdsong and a cold quilt beside me, I knew. Jamie often rose before dawn for hunting, fishing, or travel, but he invariably touched me before he left, leaving me with a word or a kiss. We'd lived long enough to know how chancy life could be, and how swiftly people could be parted forever. We'd never spoken of it, or made a formal custom of it, but we almost never parted without some brief token of affection. And now he'd gone off in the dark, without a word. "You bloody, bloody man," I said, and thumped the ground with my fist in frustration. I made my way down the hill, quilts folded under my arm, fuming. Jenny. He'd gone and talked to Jenny. Of course he had. Why hadn't I foreseen that? He'd agreed not to ask me. He hadn't said he wouldn't ask anyone else. And while Jenny clearly loved me, I'd never been under any illusions as to where her ultimate loyalty lay. She wouldn't have voluntarily given up my secret, but if her brother had asked her point blank, she would certainly have told him. The sun was spreading warmth like honey over the morning, but none of it was reaching my cold bones. He knew. And he'd gone a-hunting. I didn't need to look, but looked anyway. Jamie's rifle was gone from its place behind the door. "He came in early," Amy Higgins told me, spooning out a bowl of porridge for me. "We were all in bed still, but he called out soft, and Bobby got up to unbar the door. I would have fed him, but he said he was well enough, and away he went. Hunting, he said." "Of course," I said. The bowl was warm to my hands, and in spite of what I thought, what I knew was going on, the thick, grainy smell of it was enticing. And there was honey, and a little cream kept back from the butter-making. Amy allowed these in deference to Bobby's debauched English tastes, though she stuck to the usual virtuously Scottish salt on porridge herself. Eating settled me a little. The blunt fact was that there was absolutely nothing I could do. I didn't know the Lumpkin's name or where he lived. Jamie might. If he'd talked to Jenny right away, he could easily have sent word to Beardsley's trading post and asked who was the fat man with the port wine stain on his face. Even if he didn't yet know and was on his way to find out, I had no means of catching up with him, let alone stopping him. A Helan man canna live wi' a man who's raped his wife nearby. Nor should he. That's what Jenny had said to me. In warning, I now realized. Gack! It was wee Rob, toddling round the room, who had seized my skirt in both hands and was giving me a toothy smile, all four teeth of it.
Hungy.
Hello there, I said, smiling back despite my disquiet.
Hungry, you say?
I extended a small spoonful of honeyed porridge in his direction, and he went for it like a starving piranha. We shared the rest of the bowl in companionable silence. Rob wasn't a chatty child, and I decided that I would work in the garden today. I didn't want to go far afield, as Rachel could go into labour at any moment from the looks of it. And a short spell of solitude amid the soothing company of the vegetable kingdom might lend me a bit of much-needed calm. It would also get me out of the cabin, I reflected, as Rob, having licked the bowl, handed it back to me, toddled across the cabin, and, lifting his dress, peed in the hearth. There would be a new kitchen garden near the new house. It was measured and planned, the earth broken, and poles for the deer fence had begun accumulating. But there was little point in walking that far each day to tend a garden when there was not yet a house to live in. I minded Amy's plot in the meantime, sneaking occasional seedlings and propagules into it, between the cabbages and turnips. But today, I meant to visit the old garden. That's what the people of the ridge called it, and they didn't go there. I privately called it Malva's garden, and did. It was on a small rise behind where the big house had stood. With a new house rising already in my mind, I passed the bare spot where the big house had been without a qualm. There were more exigent things to be qualm about, I thought, and sniggered. You are losing your mind, Beecham, I murmured, but felt better. The deer fence had weathered and broken down in spots, and the deer had naturally accepted the invitation. Most of the bulbs had been pawed up and eaten, and while a few of the softer plants, like lettuce and radishes, had escaped long enough to reseed themselves, the growing plants had been nibbled to scabby white stalks. But a very thorny wild rose briar flourished away in one corner, cucumber vines crawled over the ground, and a massive gourd vine rippled over a collapsed portion of the fence, thick with infant fruits. A monstrous pokeweed rose from the centre of the patch, nearly 10 feet high, its thick red stem supporting a wealth of long green leaves and hundreds of purplish-red flower stalks. The nearby trees had grown immensely, shading the plot, and in the diffuse green light, the long, nubbly stalks looked like nudie branches, those colourful sea slugs gently swaying in currents of air rather than water. I touched it respectfully in passing. It had an odd medicinal smell, well deserved. There were a number of useful things one could do with pokeweed, but eating it wasn't one of them. Which was to say people did eat the leaves on occasion, but the chances of accidental poisoning made it not worth the trouble of preparation, unless there was absolutely nothing else to eat. I couldn't remember the exact spot where she'd died. Where the pokeweed grew? That would be entirely apropos, but maybe too poetic. Malva Christie. A strange, damaged young woman, but one I'd loved, who perhaps had loved me as well as she could. She'd been with child, and near her time when her brother, the child's father, had cut her throat here in the garden. I'd found her moments later, and tried to save the child, performing an emergency caesarean with my gardening knife. He'd been alive when I pulled him from his mother's womb, but died at once. The brief flame of his life, a passing blue glow in my hands.
Did anyone name him? I wondered suddenly.
They'd buried the baby boy with Malva, but I didn't recall anyone mentioning his name.
Adso came stalking through the weeds, eyes intent on a fat robin poking busily for worms in the corner.
I kept still, watching, admiring the lithe way in which he sank imperceptibly lower as he came more slowly, creeping on his belly for the last few feet, pausing, moving, pausing again for a long, nerve-wracking second, no more than the tip of his tail a-twitch.
And then he moved, too fast for the eye to see, and in a brief and soundless explosion of feathers, it was over.
"Well done, Cat," I said, though in fact the sudden violence had startled me a little. He paid no attention, but leapt through a low spot in the fence, his prey in his mouth, and disappeared to enjoy his meal. I stood still for a moment. I wasn't looking for Malva. The ridge folk said that her ghost haunted the garden, wailing for her child.
Just the sort of thing they would think, I thought rather uncharitably.
I hoped her spirit had fled and was at peace. But I couldn't help thinking, too, of Rachel, so very different a soul, but a young mother as well, so near her time, and so nearby.
My old gardening knife was long gone, but Jamie had made me a new one during the winter evenings in Savannah. The handle carved from a whalebone, shaped as the last one had been, to fit my hand. I took it from its sheath in my pocket and nicked my wrist, not stopping to think. The white scar at the base of my thumb had faded, no more now than a thin line, almost lost in the lines that scored my palm. Still legible, though, if you knew where to look. The letter J he had cut into my flesh just before Culloden, claiming me. I massaged the flesh near the cut gently until a full red drop ran down the side of my wrist and fell to the ground at the foot of the pokeweed. "Blood for blood," I said, the words quiet in themselves, but seeming drowned by the rustle of leaves all round. "Rest ye quiet, child, and do no harm."
Do no harm. Well, you tried. As doctor, as lover, as mother and wife, I said a silent goodbye to the garden and went up the hill toward the MacDonald's cottage. How would Jamie do it, I wondered, and was surprised to find that I did wonder, and wondered in a purely dispassionate way. He'd taken the rifle. Would he pick the man off at a distance, as if he were a deer at water? A clean shot, the man dead before he knew it. Or would he feel he must confront the man, tell him why he was about to die, offer him a chance to fight for his life? Or just walk up with the cold face of vengeance, say nothing, and kill the man with his hands? Ye canna have been married to a Hieland man all these years, and not ken how deep they can hate. I really didn't want to know. Ian had shot Alan Christie with an arrow, as one would put down a rabid dog, and for precisely similar reasons. I'd seen Jamie's hate flame bright the night he saved me and said to his men, "Kill them all." How was it now for him? If the man had been found on that night, there would have been no question that he would die. Should it be different now, only because time had passed? I walked in the sun now, but still felt cold. The shadows of Malva's garden with me. The matter was out of my hands. No longer my business, but Jamie's. I met Jenny on the path coming up briskly, a basket on her arm and her face alight with excitement. "Already?" I exclaimed. "Aye. Matthew MacDonald came down a half an hour ago to say her water's broken. He's gone to find Ian now." He had found Ian. We met the two young men in the dooryard of the cabin. Matthew, bright red with excitement. Ian, white as a sheet under his tan. The door of the cabin was open. I could hear the murmur of women's voices inside. "Ma'am," Ian said huskily, seeing Jenny.
His shoulders, stiff with terror, relaxed a little.
"Dinna fash yourself a valach,"
she said comfortably, and smiled sympathetically at him. "Your auntie and I have done this a time or two before. It will be all right."
"Granny! Granny!"
I turned to find Germaine and Fanny, both covered with dirt and with sticks and leaves in their hair, faces bright with excitement.
"Is it true? Is Rachel having her baby? Can we watch?"
How did it work, I wondered. News in the mountains seemed to travel through the air.
"What for by?" Jenny exclaimed, scandalized. "Childbed isn't any kind of a place for men. Be off with you this minute."
Germaine looked torn between disappointment and pleasure at being called a man. Fanny looked hopeful.
"I'm not a man," she said.
Jenny and I both looked dubiously at her, and then at each other.
"Well, you're no quite a woman yet either, are you?" Jenny said to her.
If not, she was close. Tiny breasts were beginning to show when she was in her shift, and her menarche wasn't far off.
"I've seen babies born?"
It was a simple statement of fact, and Jenny nodded slowly.
"Aye.
All right, then." Fanny beamed.
"What do we do?"
Germaine demanded, indignant.
"Us men?"
I smiled, and Jenny gave a deep chuckle that was older than time. Ian and Matthew looked startled, Germaine quite taken aback.
"Your uncle did his part of the business 9 months ago, lad, just as you'll do yours when it's time. Now, you and Matthew take your uncle awa' and get him drunk, eh?"
Germaine nodded quite seriously and turned to Ian.
"Do you want Amy's wine, Ian, or shall we use Grandad's good whisky, do you think?"
Ian's long face twitched, and he glanced at the open cabin door. A deep grunt, not quite a groan, came out, and he looked away, paling further. He swallowed and groped in the leather bag he wore at his waist, coming out with what looked like a rolled animal skin of some kind, and handing it to me.
"If..."
he started, then stopped to gather himself and started again.
"When the baby's born, will you wrap him, or her," he added hastily, "in this?"
It was a small skin, soft and flexible, with very thick, fine fur in shades of grey and white.
"A wolf?" I thought, surprised.
"The hide of an unborn wolf pup." "Of course, Ian," I said, and squeezed his arm.
"Don't worry. It'll be all right."
Jenny looked at the small, soft skin and shook her head.
"I doubt, lad, if that will half cover your bairn. Have you no seen the size of your wife lately?"
Chapter 145. And you know that. Jamie came home 3 days later with a large buck tied to Miranda's saddle. The horse seemed unenthused about this, though tolerant, and she waffed air through her nostrils and shivered her hide when he dragged the carcass off, letting it fall with a thump.
"Aye, lass, you've done brawly," he said, clapping her on the shoulder. "Is Ian about, an Ian?"
He paused to kiss me briefly, glancing up the hill toward the MacDonald cottage.
"I could use a bit of help with this."
"Oh, he's here," I said, smiling. "I don't know if he'll come skin your deer for you, though. He's got a new son, and won't let the baby out of his sight." Jamie's face, rather tired and worn, broke into a grin.
"A son. The blessing of Bride and Michael be on him. A braw lad?"
"Very," I assured him. "I think he must weigh almost 9 pounds.
"Poor lass," he said, with a sympathetic grimace. "And her first too. Wee Rachel's all right, though."
"Rather tired and sore, but quite all right," I assured him. "Shall I bring you some beer while you take care of the horse?"
"A good wife is prized above rubies," he said, smiling. "Come to me, Muniundun."
He reached out a long arm and drew me in, holding me close against him. I put my arms around him and felt the quiver of his muscles exhausted, and the sheer hard strength still in him that would hold him up no matter how tired he might be. We stood quite still for some time, my cheek against his chest and his face against my hair,
drawing strength from each other for whatever might come. Being married.
Amid the general rejoicing and fuss over the baby, who was still being called Oggie, his parents being spoiled for choice regarding his name, the butchering of the deer, and the subsequent feasting lasting well into the night, it was late morning of the next day before we found ourselves alone again. The only thing lacking last night was Cherry Bounce, I remarked. I never saw so many people drink so much of so many different things. We were making our way slowly up to the house site, carrying several bags of nails, a very expensive small saw, and a plane that Jamie had brought back in addition to the deer. Jamie made a small, amused sound, but didn't reply. He paused for a moment to look up at the site, presumably envisioning the outline of the house to be.
"Do you think it should maybe have a third story?" he asked. "The walls would bear it easily enough. Take careful building of the chimneys, though. Keeping them plumb, I mean."
"Do we need that much room?" I asked doubtfully. There had certainly been times in the old house when I'd wished we'd had that much room. Influxes of visitors, new emigrants, or refugees had often filled the place to the point of explosion. Mine. Providing more space might just encourage guests.
"You make it sound like they're white ants, Sassenach."
"What? Oh, termites. Well, yes, there's a strong superficial resemblance." Arrived at the clearing, I piled the nails conveniently and went to bathe my face and hands in water from the tiny spring that flowed from the rocks a little way up the hill. By the time I came back, Jamie had stripped off his shirt and was knocking together a pair of rough sawhorses. I hadn't seen him with his shirt off for a long time, and paused to enjoy the sight. Beyond the simple pleasure of seeing his body flex and move, whipcord muscles moving easily under his skin, I liked knowing that he felt himself safe here and could ignore his scars. I sat down on an upturned bucket and watched for a time. The blows of his hammer temporarily silenced the birds, and when he stopped and set the sawhorse on its feet, the air rang empty in my ears. "I wish you hadn't felt you had to do it," I said quietly. He didn't reply for a moment, but pursed his lips as he squatted and picked up a few stray nails.
"When we wed," he said, not looking at me, "when we wed, I said to you that I gave you the protection of my name, my clan, and my body."
He stood up then and looked down at me, serious.
"Do you tell me now that you no longer want that?"
No, I said abruptly. I wish you hadn't killed him, that's all. I'd managed to forgive him. It wasn't an easy thing to do, but I did it. Not permanently, but I thought I could do it permanently, sooner or later. His mouth twitched a little.
"And if you could forgive him, he needn't die, you're saying? That's like a judge letting a murderer go free because his victim's family forgave him. Or an enemy soldier sent off with all his weapons."
"I am not a state at war, and you are not my army." He began to speak, then stopped short, searching my face, his eyes intent.
"Am I not?" he said quietly.
I opened my mouth to reply, but found I couldn't. The birds had come back, and a gang of house finches chittered at the foot of a big fir that grew at the side of the clearing. "You are," I said reluctantly, and standing up, wrapped my arms around him. He was warm from his work, and the scars on his back were fine as threads under my fingers. "I wish you didn't have to be."
"Aye, well," he said,
and held me close. After a bit, we walked hand in hand to the biggest pile of barked timber and sat down. I could feel him thinking, but was content to wait until he had formed what he wanted to say. It didn't take him long. He turned to me and took my hands, formal as a man about to say his wedding vows.
"You lost your parents young, Mun Yundun, and wandered about the world rootless.
You loved Frank.
His mouth compressed for an instant, but I thought he was unconscious of it.
And of course you loved Brianna and Roger Mack and the Waynes.
But Sassenach,
I am the true home of your heart, and I know that.
He lifted my hands to his mouth and kissed my upturned palms, one and then the other, his breath warm and his beard stubble soft on my fingers.
I have loved others, and I do love many, Sassenach. But you alone hold all my heart whole in your hands, he said softly, and you know that.
We worked through the day then, Jamie fitting stones for the foundation, me digging the new garden and foraging through the woods, bringing back Pipsissewa and black cohosh, mint and wild ginger to transplant. Toward late afternoon we stopped to eat. I'd brought cheese and bread and early apples in my basket and put 2 stone bottles of ale in the spring to keep cold. We sat on the grass, leaning back against a stack of timber that was shaded by the big fir, tired, eating in companionable silence.
"Ian says he and Rachel will come up tomorrow to help," Jamie said at last, thriftily eating his apple core. "Are you going to eat yours, Sassenach?"
"No," I said, handing it over. "Apple seeds have cyanide in them, you know."
"Will it kill me?"
"It hasn't so far."
"Good."
He pulled off the stem and ate the core.
"Have they settled on a name for the wee lad yet?"
I closed my eyes and leaned back into the shade of the big fir, enjoying its sharp, sun-warmed scent. The last I heard, Rachel was suggesting Fox, for George Fox, you know. He was the founder of the Society of Friends, but naturally they wouldn't call the baby George because of the king. Ian said he doesn't think highly of foxes, though, and what about Wolf instead? Jamie made a meditative Scottish noise.
"Aye, that's no bad. At least he's not wanting to call the Wayne Rollo."
I laughed, opening my eyes. "Do you really think that's what he has in mind?"
"I know people name their children for deceased relatives, but naming one for your deceased dog?" "Aye, well," Jamie said judiciously, "he was a good dog."
"Well, yes, but..." A movement down on the far side of the cove caught my eye. People coming up the wagon road. "Look, who's that?" There were 4 small moving dots, but at this distance I couldn't make out much more than that without my glasses. Jamie shaded his eyes, peering.
"No one I ken," he said,
sounding mildly interested.
"It looks like a family, though. They've got a couple of bairns. Maybe new folk wanting to settle. I have not got much in the way of goods, though."
I squinted. They were closer now, and I could make out the disparity of height. Yes, a man and a woman, both wearing broad-brimmed hats, and a boy and a girl.
"Look, the lad's got red hair," Jamie said, smiling, and raising his chin to point. "It reminds me of Jem."
"So he does." Curious now, I got up and rummaged in my basket, finding the bit of silk in which I kept my spectacles when not wearing them. I put them on and turned, pleased as I always was to see fine detail spring suddenly into being. Slightly less pleased to see that what I had thought was a scale of bark on the timber near where I'd been sitting was, in fact, an enormous centipede, enjoying the shade. I turned my attention back to the newcomers, though. They'd stopped. The little girl had dropped something. Her dolly.
I could see the doll's hair, a splotch of colour on the ground even redder than the little boy's.
The man was wearing a pack, and the woman had a large bag over one shoulder. She set it down and bent to pick up the doll, brushing it off and handing it back to her daughter. The woman turned then to speak to her husband, throwing out an arm to point to something. The Higginses' cabin, I thought. The man put both hands to his mouth and shouted, and the wind carried his words to us, faint but clearly audible, called out in a strong, cracked voice.
"Hello, the house!" I was on my feet, and Jamie stood and grabbed my hand hard enough to bruise my fingers.
Movement at the cabin door, and a small figure that I recognized as Amy Higgins appeared. The tall woman pulled off her hat and waved it, her long red hair streaming out like a banner in the wind. "Hello, the house," she called, laughing. Then I was flying down the hill with Jamie just before me, arms flung wide, the two of us flying together on that same wind.
The end. You've been listening to Written in My Own Heart's Blood by Diana Gabaldon, narrated by Davina Porter and directed by Kathleen Gormley. The author concludes with the following notes, read here once again by Davina Porter.
Author's notes. Dams and tunnels. In the 1950s, a great hydroelectric project was started to bring power to the highlands. And in the process, many dams with turbines were built. During the construction of these dams, a good many tunnels were built, a number of them long enough to require a small electric train to transport men and equipment from one end to the other. If you're interested in this project and its history, I recommend a book called Tunnel Tigers, a first-hand account of a hydro boy in the Highlands by Patrick Campbell, though there are several other good sources. Now, Loch Eryti does exist, and it does have a dam. I don't know whether it has a tunnel exactly like the one described in the book, but if it did, that's what it would look like. The tunnel and train are taken from multiple descriptions of the hydroelectric constructions in the Highlands. My description of the dam itself, its spillway, and its turbine room are based on those at the Pitlochry Dam. Bannister Tulton and the British Legion. There will likely be a certain amount of quibbling about my inclusion of Colonel Bannister Tulton in the Battle of Monmouth, as the British Legion, of which he was a commander, a regiment of mixed cavalry and artillery, was technically not in existence until after General Clinton's return to New York following the battle. However, the British Legion did consist of two separate parts. Cavalry, under the command of Bannister Tulton, and artillery, and these parts were organized separately. The cavalry unit appears to have been in some stage of organization in early June of 1778, prior to the battle, though the artillery unit, reasonably enough, given the problems of equipping and training, was not organized until late July, after the battle, when Sir Henry Clinton had returned to New York. Now, there is no report that I can find as to the definite whereabouts of Colonel Tulton during the month of June 1778. While neither he nor his British Legion is listed in the official order of battle, that listing is admitted by every source I could find to be confused and deficient. Owing to the large number of militia units taking part, and the irregular nature of the battle, by 18th century standards, various small groups are known to have been there but were not documented, and others were there but under confusing circumstances. For example, a portion of Daniel Morgan's rifle corps was reported as taking part in the battle, but Morgan himself didn't. I don't know whether his absence was the result of illness, accident, or conflict, but apparently he wasn't there, even though he plainly intended to be. Now, if I were General Clinton, in the throes of imminent departure from Philadelphia, and more or less expecting the possibility of attack by Washington's rebels, and I had this nice new cavalry unit forming up in New York, would I not send word to Colonel Tulton to bring his men on down to lend a hand in the evacuation, and to have a bit of field experience to meld them together as a new unit? I would. And I can't think that General Clinton was less soldierly than I am. Besides, there is this interesting thing called novelistic license. I have one. Framed. The Battle of Monmouth. The battle lasted from before daylight till after dark, the longest battle of the Revolution. It was also by far the messiest battle of the Revolution. Owing to the circumstances, Washington's troops trying to catch an enemy army fleeing in three widely separated divisions, neither side could choose its ground,
and the ground over which they fought was so chopped up and patchworked with farms, creeks and forests that they couldn't fight in the usual manner, with lines facing each other, nor was it possible to develop effective flanking manoeuvres. Thus, it wasn't so much a classic 18th century battle as a very long series of pitched fights between small groups, most of whom had no idea what was going on anywhere else. And it ended up as one of those indecisive battles that no one wins, and where no one has any idea for some time afterward what the actual effects of the battle were or would be. With 200-odd years of historical perspective, the general take on the Battle of Monmouth is that it was important, not because the Americans won, but because they didn't actually lose. Washington and his troops had spent the preceding winter at Valley Forge, pulling together what men and resources they had, and forming those troops into, they hoped, a real army, with the help of Baron von Steuben, who was actually not a baron, but thought it sounded better, and other European officers who lent their services either out of idealism, for example the Marquis de Lafayette, or from a sense of personal adventure and ambition. As the Continental Army was a trifle lacking in money, they offered instant promotion as an inducement to experienced officers. A mere captain from a British or German regiment could become a colonel, or occasionally a general in the Continental Army, no questions asked. Consequently, Washington was itching to find an opportunity to try out the new army, and General Clinton provided an excellent opportunity. The fact that the new army did acquit itself very well, bar the occasional snafu, such as Lee's botched encircling manoeuvre and mistaken retreat, was a shot in the arm for the rebel cause, and gave both army and partisans new heart to continue the fight. Still, in terms both of logistics and results, the battle was one big mess. While there is a tremendous amount of material on the battle, and a great many eyewitness reports, the fragmented nature of the conflict prevented anyone from ever having a clear idea as to the overall state of things during the battle. And the staggered arrival of so many companies of militia from Pennsylvania and New Jersey meant that some companies were not documented as having been there, even though they were. Sources note several unidentified militia companies from New Jersey, for instance. These are, of course, the companies commanded by General Fraser. From a historical perspective, the Battle of Monmouth is also interesting because of the participation of so many well-known revolutionary figures, from George Washington himself to the Marquis de Lafayette, Nathanael Greene, Anthony Wayne, and Baron von Steuben. Now, when you include real people in a historical novel, you want to balance a realistic and, insofar as it is possible, accurate portrayal of them against the fact that the novel is seldom about these people. Therefore, while we do see most of them, and what we do see is based on reasonably accurate biographical information, we see them en passant, and only in situations affecting the people who are the real focus of the novel. In regard to the novelistic license mentioned above, a special embossed seal, stamped by the temporal authority, allows me to compress time when necessary. True battle aficionados, or those obsessive souls who feel compelled to construct timelines and then fret about them, will note that Jamie and Claire meet with General Washington and several other senior officers at Coriel's Ferry. Some 5 days later, we find them making preparations on the day of the battle, with little or no description of what was happening to them during the interval. That's because, while there was a tremendous amount of moving around, nothing of dramatic note happened on those 5 days. While I do strive for historical accuracy, I do also know that A, history is often not very accurate, and B, most people who really care about the logistic minutiae of battles are reading Osprey's Men-at-Arms series, or the transcript of the court-martial of General Charles Lee, not novels. Ergo, while all the officers mentioned were with Washington's army, they were not all at dinner on the same night or in the same place. Commanders and their troops came to join Washington from several places over the course of the 9 days between Clinton's exodus from Philadelphia and Washington's catching him near Monmouth Courthouse. The site of Monmouth Courthouse is now the Monmouth Hall of Records, for the benefit of people who choose to read with a map in hand. And with regard to maps and distances, etc., it's worth noting that such things as township boundaries did change between the 18th century and the 21st. Ergo, Tennant Church is now in Manalapan, New Jersey, whereas originally it was in Freehold Township. The church didn't move, the township did. The general state of the relations among those officers, though, is as shown during that dinner. Likewise, it seemed unnecessary to depict the mundane events of 5 days of travel and military conference, just to prove to the meanest intelligence that 5 days had in fact passed. So I didn't. The court-martial of General Charles Lee. Lee's lack of scouting, communications, and, not to put too fine a point on it, leadership, led to the massive retreat that nearly scuttled the American attack altogether, this being retrieved by George Washington's personal rallying of the retreating troops. In consequence, General Lee was court-martialed following the battle on charges of disobeying orders, misbehavior before the enemy, and disrespect to the commander-in-chief. He was convicted and suspended from military command for a year. There would have been a great deal of talk around Philadelphia regarding this, particularly in the household of a printer who published a regular newspaper. However, the Fraser family had other pressing concerns at the time, and so no mention was made of this. Quaker Plain Speech. The Religious Society of Friends was founded around 1647 by George Fox. As part of the society's belief in the equality of all men before God, they did not use honorific titles such as Mr. and Mrs., General, Colonel, etc., and used plain speech in addressing everyone. Now, as any of you who have a second language with Latin roots, Spanish, French, etc., realize, these languages have both a familiar and a formal version of you. So did English once upon a time. The thee and thou forms that most of us recognize as Elizabethan or biblical are, in fact, the English familiar forms of you, with you used as both the plural familiar form, all y'all, and the formal pronoun, both singular and plural. As English evolved, the familiar forms were dropped, leaving us with the utilitarian you to cover all contingencies. Quakers retained the familiar forms, though, as part of their plain speech until the 20th century. Over the years, though, plain speech also evolved, and while thee, thy remained, thou, thine largely disappeared, and the verb forms associated with thee, thy changed. From about the mid-18th century onward, plain speech used thee as the singular form of you. The plural form remained you, even in plain speech, with the same verb forms normally used for third-person singular, for example, he knows that, thee knows that. The older verb endings, knowest, doth, etc., were no longer used. If you would like to know a whole lot more about the grammatical foundations and usages of Quaker plain speech than most people normally want to, allow me to recommend to you No Need to Be Ashamed of the Plain Language by Kenneth S. P. Morse. You can find this on the QuakerJane.com website, or Google it, in case that website should no longer be extant. Scots, Scotch, Scottish. As noted elsewhere, Lord John and the Brotherhood of the Blade, see author's notes, in the 18th century, and indeed well into the mid-20th century, the word Scotch and its variants, for example Scotchman, were commonly used by both English people and Scots to describe an inhabitant of Scotland. The terms Scottish and Scots were also occasionally used, though less common. Personally, I don't think political correctness has any place in historical fiction, and therefore those persons in this book who normally would have used Scotch do.
typos and terminology. Owing to the interesting idiosyncrasies of Scots dialect, some words may appear to be misspelled, but they aren't. For instance, while an English cook may have made her flapjacks on an iron griddle, her Scottish counterpart was frying sausages on a hot girdle. This occasional transposition of sounds results in such entertaining items as a Scottish dessert known as creamed crud, curd to the less imaginative English. It also results in the occasional inattentive reviewer denouncing the occurrence of typos in my books. This is not to say there aren't any typos. There always are, no matter how many eyeballs have combed the pages. Just that girdle isn't one of them. Besides dialectical idiosyncrasies, there are also the oddities due to obsolete but entirely accurate usage. For example, at one point in this book, you will find someone hiding behind a pile of spiled barrels. I do not mean spoiled, and it isn't a typo. Spiled means that a spile, a small wooden peg or spigot, has been driven into a cask in order to broach it and draw off liquid. So the pile is composed of barrels that have been drained of their contents. Yes, I could indeed have said a pile of empty barrels instead, but what fun would that be? Bibliography/library thing. Having been an academic for a good long time, I appreciate the virtues of a good bibliography. Having been a reader of novels for a lot longer, I sort of don't think extensive bibliographies belong in them. Still, one of the side effects of reading historical fiction often is a desire to learn more about events, locations, flora, fauna, etc., described therein. I have a goodish number of references, about 1,500 last time I counted, acquired over the last 20-odd years of writing historical fiction, and I'm happy to share the bibliographic information for these. As it's not convenient to do that individually with a large number of people, I've put my whole reference collection, as of the beginning of 2013 at least, on Library Thing, this being an online bibliographic site where people can catalogue and share their personal library information. My catalogue is public, and you should be able to access all of it using my name as a keyword. Individual references also include keywords like medicine, herbal, biography, etc.
If you've enjoyed this book and this performance, Recorded Books recommends Diana Gabaldon's The Space Between, an Outlander novella, also narrated by Davina Porter. Joan McKimmy is on her way to Paris to take up her vocation as a nun. Yet her decision is less a matter of faith than fear. Joan is plagued by mysterious voices that speak of the future, and by visions that mark those about to die. The sanctuary of the nunnery promises respite from these unwanted visitations, or so she prays. Her chaperone is Michael Murray, a young widower who, though he still mourns the death of his wife, finds himself powerfully drawn to his charge. But when the time-travelling Count Saint-Germain learns of Joan's presence in Paris and of her link to Claire Fraser, Murray is drawn into a battle whose stakes aren't merely the life, but the very soul of the Scotswoman who, without even trying, has won his heart. Recorded Books offers a wide selection of bestsellers, mysteries, classics, histories, and more. So look for us at your public library or on download sites online. And thank you for being a Recorded Books reader.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.